Welcome to the Blazing Ember podcast, where we aim to amplify the voices of Latino professionals. We, Diana and Maria, founded this podcast to explore unspoken rules and all the ships, leadership, mentorship, sponsorship, and allyship with Latino leaders.
We are here to ignite your path to success with valuable insights. Bienvenidos.
Hola. Today, we're back with the amazing Maria Melendez, who you may remember was a former chief diversity officer and a retired partner at Sidley Austin. We learned about her career journey, passion for diversity, success as a litigator, and obviously success as a Latina in private practice. We also know Maria from her extensive volunteer work, which we're going to talk about a bit in this podcast. So thank you so much for coming back and making time for us again.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you.
So I want to kind of start with, you referenced these three pillars for diversity, and we talked a little bit about it towards the end of the last call. But I was hoping you could spend a little bit of time kind of walking us through the three pillars again to remind everybody, and then talk a little bit about kind of what steps companies can do or organizations can take to have these be part of their culture.
Sure. No, happy to do that. I think let me step back for a second. As we talked a little bit about last time we were together, when I decided to accept the role of CDO for the firm, I spent a bit of time just reflecting back on my own career, which at that time had spanned almost 30 years, and the work that I and many, many, many others in and around the law firm that I was with, Sidley, and also, you know, other law firms and other law departments and various different clients that I talked with about diversity and how can we do a better job. I reflected a lot on that and the fact that notwithstanding all of the time, money, and energy that had been invested in advancing diversity in the profession, we were still very, very far behind where any of us wanted to be. And that really sort of made me think, well, what can we be doing differently? What are the things that I have observed in my own career and then in the career, successful careers of others that I think could make a difference in how we approach diversity in the legal profession? And that's how I came up with these three, what I call three pillars, right? The first one was the idea that we should be approaching our diversity efforts with a global mindset. I found that in my travels over almost three decades, we tend to be in the United States very US-centric when it comes to identifying issues and problem solving in and around diversity. So I thought, you know, Sidley is a global law firm. We have colleagues all around the world. What are they doing in those various jurisdictions that we can learn from? And I found that that was helpful. And it even was helpful to think about, you know, Sidley, for example, has at the time 10, 11 offices in the US, 10 or 11 offices outside the US. Within each of those markets in the United States itself, we have offices in the Northeast, we have offices in the Midwest, we have offices in the South. I found that the cultures were different, the approaches to diversity were different. And so there was things that we could learn from one another, even just within the United States. So having a global mindset and approach to an open mind to doing something different, right, than what we had been doing in the last 30 years. So that was number one, global mindset. Number two was inclusion. But when I think about and talk about inclusion, it's really more about the idea that we have spent, and by we, I mean the legal profession. And I think this is fair to say, you know, almost in every profession, you know, corporate America, the judiciary, Fortune 500 company, any institution, academia, any institution that's really interested in advancing diversity, we tend to isolate ourselves, right, by category or by group. So many women's groups and the women's group will do events and host activities for just women. And the Latino groups, they would host and gather and do events with only Latinos. And you go down the list of other diversity groups. And that's wonderful and that's great. And I applaud that. And it's necessary and needed because I think there's what I like to think of a feeding the soul when you think about hanging out or interacting or being with your tu gente, right? You feel like that certain kind of special way when you're around people of similar backgrounds.
It's also a safe space, right? I mean, it's a place where you feel like you can let your hair down and it's okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's an instant affinity when you're with people of similar backgrounds that is just wonderful. And it's heartwarming and it's uplifting and everything like that. Right. And that's great. But I think what's missing in our approach to this point has been an intentional attention to attracting people of different backgrounds to these various groups and these various efforts, right? So if you go to an event that's hosted by, say, Latino Justice, which I know we'll talk about a little bit later, and I sit around the gala space, right, for our annual gala, and you look around and it's a wonderful, beautiful sea of mostly Latinos, right? Which on the one hand, I was extremely proud and happy for. But on the other hand, I'm like, you know, it would be great if we had more white people in this room, if we had more Asian people in this room, if we had more, you know, Black people in this room, if we had more women in this room, you know, any different diversity group. I think we will learn and grow and identify, problem solve in a better, more effective way if we mingle more, mingle more across our various differences. So that's what I mean by inclusion. And the third pillar is impactful relationships, right? And what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is I reflected on my own personal career. I found that I think this is fair to say for almost anyone who's had success in the profession, is you've had someone or a group of someones who have taken you by the hand and shown you the ropes. And without that kind of guidance and without that kind of opportunity, it doesn't matter that we are, you know, strong work ethic. It doesn't matter that we have talent and that we're smart and that we're driven. You will not be successful in this profession unless and until you have access to opportunity to develop and hone your skills, right? And if you have people in your organization who are senior to you, who have power and influence to direct the types of cases that you are, you know, assigned to, the types of deals that you're assigned to, and that give you the opportunity to cut your teeth, to you learn your craft, you're not going to be successful in this profession, right? Because at the end of the day, it's about making money. It's about it's a business, right? And right. And clients are going to hire, right? Clients are going to hire the best and the brightest. When they come to a law firm like Sidley, or they come to a law firm, you know, any law firm,
right,
they're looking for not just the talent, but the people with experience, right? And what I have found coming up through the ranks, and you talk to other women and you talk to other, you know, underrepresented individuals in the profession, what I walked away with more often than not, it's not that they don't have work ethic. Of course not. It's not that they don't have talent. Of course they do. They're overflowing with talent. But what they lacked was that access to opportunities to develop their skills, to have experience, right? Because once you have experience, you learn that, you know, you not only do you learn your skill, but then you also acquire what I call that, you know, most important ingredient of all, which is confidence, right? If you have the confidence to do whatever it is that you've been assigned, whatever task you've been assigned to do, you will kill it 9 times out of 10. So when I talk about and I think about impactful relationships, what I'm thinking about is, okay, how do we help our women and other underrepresented colleagues in the profession develop those impactful relationships, relationships with people that have the access and power and influence to make a difference in someone's career? And so those are the three pillars that really were driving and do continue to drive my thinking around DEI.
So that was a lot, and it's very helpful, I think. But I think it's a nice, somewhat simple recipe, and then there are kind of parts to everything, right? Like in the impactful relationships, right, the way you were thinking about it now is what we call like allyship, mentorship, all the relationships, right? That we discuss in a D&I space today. It probably just wasn't known as that when you got started in this space. One thing that I'd like to go back to is this global mindset, right? Like you mentioned the diversity of views on the issue globally and even, you know, nationally. Can you tell us more about that? Like what key differences did you see, and what do you think it takes to develop that global mindset and then the approach to these problems?
Sure. I think that, you know, what I found over the years thinking about and working towards advancing diversity in the US, my focus, and this is before I became CDO, my focus was primarily domestic, right? So what were we doing in and around my home office was in New York. So what were we doing around New York primarily? And then, you know, later in the years, I started to identify and work with colleagues around the other offices in the US and trying to learn what they were doing that was perhaps different than anything we had tried and was effective. Right. When I became CDO, I had an opportunity to expand my access to information in that regard by talking to folks in our London office, our Frankfurt offices, our offices in Singapore, offices in Hong Kong, and offices in Beijing, Shanghai. And I began to realize that no office is perfect, right? No jurisdiction, no marketplace has figured out, you know, the answer to these issues completely. But within each of those different markets, what I found was that there were certain things that they were doing that was much more effective than what we were doing in the US. And we hadn't even yet begun to think about those kinds of things. And you think about more globally, for example, you know, in Europe as it relates to the retention of women, for example, they have family leave policies and procedures that are much different than what we have in the US, right? One of the biggest surprises that I found was in talking to colleagues and to other clients in the German markets, right? They have the men in those offices and the men that I spoke to at clients in that region had a tremendous focus and attention to the retention of women, especially those that were about to go on maternity leave. They were adamant about making sure that, you know, not only was there a plan for, you know, their wind down before they went on maternity leave, but the wind back up when they came back from maternity leave, right? And I found that to be, you know, fascinating because in the US, my experience had been that those kinds of issues are driven more by the women in the various yes. different US markets, yeah. right? Those are the people That's that right. were paying. Yeah, right. And then When I'm working with folks in our, you know, Europe, it wasn't just Germany, it was other offices as well. I found it fascinating that conversation was being driven not by the women, but by the men. And so I started to learn more about, okay, what is it? And they were just, there's a cultural embrace of having more women in the profession, I found, in dealing with my colleagues in Europe than I had really, you know, found to be as intentional and driven
here in the US
in other offices, right? Dealing that, and again, it's not limited to, you know, one specific law firm or another. It's collectively, right? When I talk to other people in other offices and I talk to clients, right? When generally speaking, when you're talking about, you know, the retention and promotion of women, it tends to be driven more so by women than women. By men. In Hong Kong, there is a tremendous effort around supporting and retaining LGBTQ plus community. And that I found fascinating, right? Both by clients in the markets in the regions and by law firms in the markets in the regions. And there's a whole, you know, very active engagement with the LGBT community in our Asian offices, which in our Asian markets, which I thought was just very interesting and trying to drill down, okay, why is that? And how can we hone that and bring it back to the United States? So those are some examples in Europe too, the focus there that I found very interesting and I think extremely helpful is on diversity from a socioeconomic perspective, right? So there, it's not just, you know, black, white, black, green, purple, whatever. It's everybody who happens to fall within a certain socioeconomic levels, right? Let's talk about how do we advance and, you know, recruit, retain, promote those folks and diversity in that respect, which is also something that, you know, I have not encountered as much in the US. So those are some of the things that, you know, just off the top of my head that I can think of, Diana, to answer your question, that I thought was helpful, instructive, and you know, something that we could, I think, be more aware of in the US that could be helpful.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it gives you, it's very important to, especially in this day and age. I mean, there's no way of escaping a global economy. And so to just have one lens, one local lens, even national lens to look at these issues is just simply too narrow. It's not really acceptable, right? You do need to look at how the people who are in different offices or in different spaces are thinking about diversity, inclusion, equity. It all just has a different flavor to it based on where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. And it feeds into, because these three pillars really do kind of feed and work off each other, right? So having that global mindset also helps you be more intentional when it comes to inclusion, right? For the same exact reasons. Right. The more that we can engage with one another and the more that we can engage with people of different backgrounds, right? I think the more effective we will all be in accomplishing the ultimate goals of having a more diverse and inclusive workforce. If, you know, you're talking about institutions and more diverse and inclusive academic body, if you're talking about, you know, academia, whatever the field is, I really do think. And I also think that even, you know, I don't want to necessarily get into politics, but I think, you know, if we, one of the things that I moved from New York and I'm now in Tennessee and, you know, it's a very different political environment here. Yes. Than it is in the Northeast. And coming to this area, I was kind of, okay, what am I going to encounter? And yeah, sure. I have encountered many, many folks who are of different political, you know, leanings, if you will. But I also have found that those same people are, you know, very kind and I've enjoyed meeting them. I've enjoyed getting to know them. I've enjoyed, you know, having relationships with them. And we do have conversations around some things that are very, you know,
sensitive,
complex,
yes.
Complex,
yeah.
Complex.
Yes.
Complex. Yes.
Yeah.
But we're doing so with respect and with an open mind to learning, which I, yeah. This is which at the end of the day,
we don't do that anymore. Want.
We don't do that anymore. Yeah, we don't do that anymore. And I, that's a shame, right? Because instead of doing that, we kind of, you know, get into our own little silos and we close out any other potential, you know, way of thinking. And I think that's dangerous. I think, you know, it continues to lead to this divisiveness that we're seeing. And that's unfortunate.
Yeah, I often used to use this. There's a DEI kind of little game. I am, but I am not. And I often would use that. So you would say, for example, I am Latina, but I am not a drug dealer. Or I am Latina, but I am not undocumented. I am Latina, but I am not. And it's the stereotypes, right? It's the stereotypes. So I'm Italian, but I'm not in the mafia, right? And so what you begin to do is to begin to have those conversations about the stereotypes that exist. And one of the individuals who was a woman said, I am a mother. But I am not ambitious. I am ambitious. She's like, just because I'm a mother doesn't mean. So it creates this conversation around those points, which is what are the stereotypes we believe in? Who am I? And frankly, in the conversations, you begin to find commonalities. And you begin to see that, yes, I may be Latina, but you know, you also have this issue. I think that's a little bit of it. And so I looked at your LinkedIn profile and I saw this statement and I'm just going to quote it because I think it kind of sums up, you know, really why those statements all apply, your three pillars. And it is, I am committed to the principle that having lawyers of all backgrounds greatly enriches Sidley's perspective of the legal landscape and enhances its ability to serve its clients. And I just thought, that's it. You've captured it, right?
Mic drop. That's a mic drop.
That's a mic drop statement. I was like, got it.
Yepa, right?
Yepa, yeah. Parriba, vamos, pa'lante, we're done. So now I want to ask you, okay, so we're in the world that we're in, right? DEI is under massive attack. When you look to the future, what do you see in terms of changes to the legal industry for diverse lawyers? If you had a crystal ball, what would you tell us?
Well, I'm the eternal optimist, right? So notwithstanding the, as you said, and correctly so, the backlash, which is just overwhelming sometimes, I do believe that there are more people, particularly in the legal profession, that are committed to advancing diversity in the profession. And there are more people like that than the ones that have the megaphone right now and are, you know, spouting off these, you know, you talk about stereotypes, you know, what I'm hearing in what I'm picking up on the backlash that we're, you know, talking about is this sentiment or this bias or this stereotype that is something that goes something to the effect of, well, you know, to advance diversity, you are necessarily putting people into positions that are unqualified, right? You're untalented, unqualified, you know, token, you know, women and diverse folks into these roles in order to achieve diversity, which is such BS, right? That is absolutely, at least certainly not in my experience, not in my world, have I ever encountered a situation where someone of diverse background was, you know, advanced or hired or promoted without the necessary, you know, foundational requirement of talent, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
That's just, it's offensive and it mm-hmm. leads to stigma mm-hmm. and just, you know, a rabbit hole of depression, right? For people yes. who are tagged with that
around.
Stigma. It's yes. devastating, right? You think about, you know, in the legal profession, we're limited to the legal profession. You graduate from law school, you're at the top of your class, wherever law school you went to, you're hired by, you know, one of these law firms, big law firms, or you're hired into one of the, you know, law departments of a major corporation. And because you are, you know, of diverse background, you're automatically thought of as someone who didn't deserve to be there, right? Like, oh my God, this person just got here because of, you know, whatever, our diversity efforts. And that's demoralizing. And that's just so, so devastating to that individual. And it causes what I was saying earlier, you know, the lack of confidence sometimes, right? Because when you are one of a few in any institution, mm-hmm. you tend to feel less confident, right? Most people. There's some people that walk into the work environment and they may know nothing, right? They may have right. absolutely know nothing, but they have that confidence, right? But those are very rare, right? Most people that, you know, are coming into, particularly first generation folks, right? They're walking into a office environment and more likely than not, they're going to be a little bit shy and a little bit, you know, less confident. And if you don't have someone, you know, or an institution who is mindful of that phenomena, right? And therefore has in place processes by which they identify, you know, bring everybody together and convey, hey, you know what? You're my person, right? You're my guy. You're my woman. You're here because you deserve to be here. And you give them the opportunities to demonstrate and, you know, show everybody that they got it, right? They have the talent, they have the skills, they just need the experience. And they need that, you know, the experience, because that experience is going to breed and enhance that confidence that they need to be successful. You know, it's not going to happen. So I think that the profession, if there's been anything, you know, that has come out of the diversity conversation over the last 34 years, I think it's extremely positive. It is the awareness and the desire to make sure that our profession can, you know, continues to become as diverse as it can be, right? And there are people that are, you know, committed to that and committed, you know, 100%. They're going to be bruised right now, right? I think we're all taking jabs. We're all taking, you know, all of our respective institutions are taking jabs here and there, and it's going to probably last a little bit. But I think at the end of the day, the will of those currently in leadership across these law firms and these law departments, I think, is stronger than the negativity that we're seeing and the, you know, the pot shots and cheap shots that are being taken by, you know, the folks that have nothing better to do than, you know, step on folks that are trying to do the right thing.
So I think you're right, Marie. And I think, you know, there's a lot of positive education that has come out of the discussion. And hopefully, I'm hoping that the education and the discussion of, for example, what has been the last, you know, decade and a half-ish since I've, you know, been in the legal field as a student, as a young attorney, that is something that will be hard to remove from the system. Even if it is temporarily attacked, I hope it's temporarily, but we'll see, right? In that time, there's been enough change that is done, to your point, that people won't just let it go, right? Just let it go for naught. So I want to pivot into your nonprofit work, because you've done a lot of it. You have a lot of passion outside of what your normal day responsibilities, professional responsibilities were. You did a lot in the nonprofit space. And you were a leader, you gave back to that community. And, you know, I know you personally from, you know, Latino Justice, formerly known as Pearl Def. You were a, you know, member of the board of directors, you were an executive committee member, then you were the chair of the board of directors, which is when I think I even had the pleasure of coming into one of your meetings at the end as a young board member and seeing you work and do, as a leader and seeing you do your work. And it was frankly it was the first time I think I had been at a board of directors meeting in a nonprofit. So it was very interesting to see such a powerful group of people and then a woman, no less, at the helm. Leading
badass chair.
Wait, what did you say, Maria?
I said a badass chair.
Yes, there we go. Badass chair. Welcoming us all in a younger generation to leadership, right? To drive the nonprofit to its next stage. And you also served at the board of directors of Her Justice, which was, you know, to some known as In Motion years ago. And this organization provided free legal services to low-income women. And I believe now that I'm thinking about it, I think I provided like translation services as a law student to somebody who was looking to leave a situation full of domestic violence and abuse.
Yeah.
If I'm mistaken, right? It was
In Motion, Her Justice. Yeah. That organization helped victims of domestic violence, you know, get divorces from abusive spouses, get child support, child custody, et cetera. And one of the things that attracted me to Her Justice is the fact that, and unfortunately this was true back when I was on the board in the late, you know, early 2000s through 2009, 10, something like that, most of their client base, and this is organizations based in New York City, most of their client base is Latina. Over 50% of the clients that In Motion, now Her Justice, represented were Latina women in New York City. And that, you know, that was among the reasons why I was attracted to that organization.
And I'll add, I think it was, from my experience, Her Justice was mostly young women. And what I knew is that they also looked for like a safe haven. Like they had to find a safe house to really save their lives and the lives of their children.
Yeah. These were women whose lives were literally at risk at the hands of, you know, sometimes it was just a partner, you know, sometimes it was their husband. And these were men who were, you know, ordinary quote-unquote men to, you know, professional men to law enforcement folks. I mean, these were, you know, it was heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking what these women were going through. And more often than not, there were children involved also. And it just gives you some insight into the ugly, right? The ugly of how humans treat one another and humans that are ostensibly in a quote-unquote loving, you know, relationship, and it's heartbreaking. But yes, I loved doing that work.
So can you tell us a little bit about like how you got started in your nonprofit, you know, volunteer work and what, you know, drove you to participate in the space for so many years? What do you think is important for, I mean, people outside of even the legal profession to know about this type of work?
Yeah, sure. So what got me down this path was, you know, when I went to law school, my intention was originally to, you know, go to law school and then, you know, become a public defender, become, you know, a prosecutor. And the idea there was I wanted to be in a position to help, you know, people like me, right? I wanted to be able to help people that were in a socioeconomic class that could not afford attorney, in underrepresented communities that could not and did not have access to legal counsel. I wanted to give back to my people, right? That was sort of the thinking coming and going, you know, I was going to law school and coming out of law school. And coming out of law school, I was fortunate enough to get an offer to join the Manhattan DA's office. And then I also received an offer to join my first law firm, Breed, Abbott & Morgan. And at the time, if I remember correctly, the starting salary for a young prosecutor was like in the early, you know, low 30s, if I remember correctly. And the starting salary at the law firm was $83,000. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I said, hey, this is a big difference, right? So I have some law school loans and I'm thinking, okay, I will go do the law firm work there for a couple of years, make some money to pay off my loans, and then I will go to the DA's office, or I will go to the public defender, legal aid, et cetera. And what I found, and that, so that was my master plan. What I found when I got to the law firm, and by then, you know, year two, year three out of law school, for me, I was at what is now Sidley. Their pro bono practice at the law firm was just incredibly robust. And we had, as young associates, we had the opportunity and were encouraged by the law firm to do more pro bono work. So I was like, I raised my hand immediately and I started my first pro bono work was with representing as co-counsel Latina women and any other women who were clients of her in at the time in motion, now her justice. Helping them seek their divorce decrees, helping them to, you know, obtain protection orders to child custody, child support, et cetera. And I did that, you know, type of work for many, many years because I just found it incredibly fulfilling. And it allowed me to do what I wanted to do, right? Help, quote unquote, my people. That was my dream coming out of law school, while at the same time building wealth, right? And what I learned, because I was fortunate enough to be at a place that allowed me to kind of not only do my day job, as you said, Maria, but also to, you know, give back to the community through pro bono, I found it to be the best of both worlds, right? Because the other thing that I also learned over the course of my, particularly early on in the legal profession, is that in order to help these pro bono organizations, in order to help Justice, in order to help Latino justice, and in order to help some of the other organizations, nonprofits that I've been affiliated with, you need money, right? You need to, you know, not only give your time, but you also need to give your treasure. Right. And, you know, there aren't a lot of people, as we've, you know, been talking about earlier, there are not a lot of people of diverse backgrounds, first generation folks in these private law firms that are able to, you know, donate money at the levels that these nonprofits need, right? And so it became so clear to me, like, and that, you know, when I talk to young people coming out of law school, I often tell them, and many of them have the same drive and desire that I did coming out of law school, which is to come back into the public sector, right? Graduate from law school, go to the public sector, because you want to, you know, give back and help people right. like you. And that's awesome. And that's wonderful. And I applaud that. But what I also share with them is like, you know what? You can also help and have perhaps an even greater impact on your community by building wealth. Making money is a good thing. Making money is a good thing. Building that wealth and being able to financially support the organizations that you care about. And so you kind of can do both things if you have access to those kinds of opportunities. And so the more I, you know, as years passed and I was continued and supported by Sidley to be invested in the community, because their Sidley is very big in trying to get people, their lawyers, to give back to their communities. And so I found that I was able to do both, to, you know, support the institutions that I cared about, the pro bono institutions that I care about, with both my time and treasure. And it continues to be to this day one of the best things I've ever done, you know, professionally is to be involved with these organizations.
That's wonderful. Yeah. And I kind of share that sentiment, because when I first got out of law school, I was like, okay, but I'm the type of person that if you're doing one case at a time, it would drive me nuts, right? Versus trying to change the system. And that's a bigger process than just me doing public service was ever going to be able to do. And I think, you know, one of the things from IBM was that oftentimes IBM was willing to support, whether it was doing some of these pro bono activities or whether it was giving money. You know, I remember we hosted a session for Latino Justice when they were going through some financial issues. God, that was like 20 something years ago. And we paid for the facilitators and the space and the food to have that open conversation. So there's ways to do it. So Maria, we could keep talking to you forever, right? And you know that. But before we wrap up, just kind of want to ask you to give us a final takeaway for listeners, something that they should keep in mind as they strive to ignite their own ember.
I'm all ears. I'm waiting for the nugget.
Well, I think, and this maybe hopefully ties our conversation over the last two sessions, as it relates to women in the profession and as it relates to, you know, people of diverse backgrounds, racial and ethnic diversity, sexual orientation, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, you've graduated law school, you're now entering the profession, whether it's in private practice, public practice, corporate America, whatever you may be, you will find that you are in more often than not going to be one of a few in these environments, right? But do not let that become a crutch and a negativity for you, right? Which it tends to be for many people. It tends to be something that becomes a hindrance to the advancement of their careers, as opposed to what I like to think about it, flip it on its head, and it should be more of your propeller, right? Because you are the only person in that room. You have a captive audience. You have the ability in that environment to show your stuff, right? So what I tell people in those environments, be bold, right? If you have done the research, you prepared for that meeting, you've read the cases, whatever it may be, share your opinions, share your thoughts. Do not be shy about, you know, whatever it is that's on the conversation. Because you, like I said, because you're one of a few in that room, everyone's going to be looking at you. So this is, think of it more as an opportunity. So be bold. And then by the same token, be visible. Don't blend into the wall just because, you know, oh my God, I'm the only one that looks like me. You know, let me hide so nobody sees me. No, step into the room. Step into the room. Be visible. So be bold, be visible. And lastly, be epic. Just kill it. You have the talent. You have everything it takes. Just go for it, right? So be bold, be visible, be epic. I love it.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to get a t-shirt. I'm going to get a t-shirt that says that.
That would be awesome. Yes. I'm up for one of those t-shirts.
Ladies, it has been a pleasure.
Thank you. Yes, and you know, we really shared so much about your life, the leadership path that you've taken, and how to make the legal profession a better one. But I think your view on so many of the issues we discussed really applies even outside of the legal profession. It's something that any industry can really appreciate. So thanks again, and you know, we look forward to seeing where the road takes you.
Oh well, thank you. I'll come back. I have some things in the works. We'll see.
Oh, yes. That's a promise. And it's recorded. It's on the record. Talk to you
soon. Have a wonderful holiday, ladies. Hasta luego. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for tuning in to the Blazing Ember podcast and our journey to empowerment. Look out for more episodes to keep your ember blazing.
Visit blazingember.com where you can connect with us and share your feedback. Hasta pronto.